Hi, I'm Zoe, and this is What a Body Can Do, explorations of the body in the social world.
What can bodies do?
We still don't know what bodies can do.
The question of the body.
The possibilities inside of us.
There's still so much we don't know.
Let's find out what a body can do. Welcome to episode number one. I'm so excited to put this project out into the world. Thanks for taking the time to listen. To introduce myself a little bit, I'm Zoe. I'm a somatic practitioner currently based in Philadelphia on Lenape land. I run Third Space Somatics, and I work with clients one-on-one, primarily with queer and trans folks and artists, activists. I also facilitate groups and lead workshops. I've been fascinated by somatics and bodies for a long time and have studied through various lineages. My fascination led me to grad school, where I studied embodiment from a bunch of different angles, including philosophy, art, neuroscience, queer, feminist, and critical theory. And it's really exciting to me when all of these different angles for approaching embodiment can talk to each other and be in conversation with each other. And that's my hope for this project. We'll be coming from all of these different angles, using art as research, audio as research, poetry as research, our bodies as research. I say we because this podcast is going to be very collaborative, and I'm super excited about that. And because of the collaborative nature of it, each episode is going to be very different. The first two episodes will primarily be my voice. And episode 3 will be the first collaborative experiment. This first episode is going to be a little longer probably than most of them, and it's an audio essay that I have been working on since grad school. It's about what somatics can teach us about how ideology works and how toxic ideologies like white supremacy and whiteness itself can be approached in order to dismantle them and take their power away. Ideology has been such a hot topic in the last year and 4 years, really, as there's been so much public debate about what facts are, what drives people, what motivates people to do what they do, believe what they believe. And I'm not just talking about conspiracy theories here, but also about the things that it's really easy to take for granted or to not notice, things that feel so normal. Like whiteness feels to white bodies, like mine. How can we put a critical lens to these more hidden forces and feelings that shape our ideas? And that's what I explore in this episode. And I hope it can be a small contribution to this conversation about ideology. Hope you enjoy. Despite all of the ideological rhetoric we're drowning in, we're rarely, if ever, making rational calculations or unmediated decisions about what we think and believe. Our ideas, our beliefs, our positions are most often formed retroactively, after we've been stirred to move in one way or another by the conditions and context that we're thinking about something within. Ideologies are positions. They're more closely related to how and where we're standing than what we're thinking.
Stand up for what you believe in.
Don't be a pushover.
I don't know, I'm kind of leaning towards, like...
As much as I want to believe that we shape politics, the reality is that politics shapes us just as much. I don't mean to say that we have no agency, that we're nothing more than a product of our environments, but I do mean to say that agency as a concept, just an American Stars and Stripes, could use a serious makeover. My hope in this essay is not to redress the concept, just to undress it, to expose the shapes and crevices that so often go unseen. In 1975, Michel Foucault wrote about how historical forces actually shape our bodies in literal ways. He identified one of the key moments in history in which social alignment and muscular alignment began to coincide. The mechanical age had opened up the possibility of seeing society as a mass of individual parts that could be manipulated. He laid out a series of ways that the curation of social space began to shape bodies into the ideal image of a docile, productive worker. By implementing a controlled environment, ruled by expectation and punishment for misalignment, with a singular mode of fitting, posture was gradually corrected. He writes, "A calculated constraint runs slowly through each part of the body, mastering it, making it pliable, ready at times, turning silently into the automism of habit." Habit. 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 Habit is the key word. It's like when you say a word a bunch of times in a row and then it starts to completely disappear in front of you and lose its meaning and you can't make sense of it anymore. When you do something over and over and over, it just becomes regular, it becomes normal, it becomes just how you are. It starts to slowly disappear. As the queer theorist Sarah Ahmed says, this paradox, with effort it becomes effortless, is precisely what makes history disappear in the moment of its enactment. In my 20s, I briefly worked with a direct action campaign in the coal country of Appalachia. We were organizing to stop mountaintop removal, which is a way of extracting coal by blowing the top off of a mountain and killing everything in the way. Despite the visible reality that the workers of these mines and machines were overworked, overwhelmed, underpaid, their bodies shaped by years of dangerous and difficult maneuvering, many of them were just unwilling to reorient themselves to other economic possibilities. Their work was instead a matter of heritage, a matter of belonging. Coal mining was socially in alignment with the values of hard work, strength, the imperative of being a patriarchal provider for the family. All of this together, in practice, was more powerful, actually had more force, than the fact that they could no longer literally drink the water in their own houses because of the toxic waste flowing from their job sites. I can't begin to imagine what it would be like to be them, situated in a context I will never understand. The drive to put food on the table, the smell of the coal listening generations of historical memory, family, pride. Their towns were already being left behind economically and had been for generations, trusting a new company to come in with wind power or solar power or something like that after decades of wearing the same logo on their worn and dusty work shirts. There was no rational argument that could change their ideas. It became clear that we were not fighting mountaintop removal. We were confronting a culturally and somatically constructed idea, an effect, a feeling. And that's what would first have to be addressed if the practice of mountaintop removal was ever going to change. And frankly, we weren't equipped to do that. We live in a culture that belittles emotional vitality, equating being emotional with being out of control. The lineage of Descartes, the reductionist of Western models of the body, the capitalist suppression of all that is not efficient or calculable, the suppression of women, among other historical factors, have shaped our view of emotions. I'm interested in exploring the role and function of emotions. What do they do? Not only can we not distinguish mind from body as if they're separate things, we cannot distinguish emotion from ideology. Let's talk about Spinoza, one of my favorite 17th century philosophers. He made a distinction between adequate ideas and inadequate ideas. Adequate ideas, he says, are ideas that express the full story, the complete nature of the thing that is being attempted to express. Inadequate ideas, in contrast, are incomplete. If I said, for example, that coffee is bitter, this is an inadequate idea. It's not untrue, but there's so much more that could be said. Coffee is so many other things, too. My expression of this one aspect of coffee is an incomplete or inadequate idea, according to Spinoza. What's important to note is that inadequate ideas are not false. Spinoza actually says that nothing is false, actually. Everything, every opinion and expression contains some aspect of a true feeling, some aspect of something that is real. Whether it encompasses the full story or whether it is completely misguided is another question. Another term that Spinoza employs for inadequate ideas is affection ideas. What he means by this is that we often form our ideas based on how the object of those ideas makes us feel, how it lands on our bodies, the impressions that press against our flesh and form us anew. As the etymology of the word emotions says very clearly, emotions involve motion. They pull us in certain directions. They can tug us toward action or twist us into indecision. Think about what it's like when you feel angry. Maybe you feel heat. Maybe your heart rate speeds up. Do your fists or legs clench, preparing to fight? Take a moment to shape your body into an angry expression and take notice of how you automatically do that. What happens with your eyes or your face? What about your stomach or your lower body? Stay in this position for a while and just notice it. Exaggerate it to feel it more. Make some sounds. What are your eyes doing? Are you breathing? What automatic stories or thoughts come with this shape? Sensations are almost always accompanied by an impulse, whether that impulse is to move, to collapse, to constrict. There's often some kind of contraction involved. What we call an emotion is an interpretation of the sensation and its accompanying motion impulse. Most often, without carefully studying the physiology of our emotional reactions, as we do in somatics, we don't intuitively or automatically always know why we feel how we feel, or even how we feel how we feel, or even that we feel that we feel. Coming back to this idea of adequate and inadequate ideas, let's borrow a basic example from Deleuze. I may feel the effect of the sun on my body. What I know to be true is that I feel warm and tingly. Yet unless I am a physicist with a sense of neurobiology, I don't know the extent to why this is true. I don't know the constitution of the sun and why it changes the constitution of my body upon touch. This encounter with the sun changes me. This I know through a felt sense, but why or how exactly, I don't know. Inadequate or affection ideas consists of a knowledge of their effects without the knowledge of their causes. I don't know what the workers of the coal field felt. I imagine it was a sense of pride, a connection to heritage, a defensiveness that this heritage would be lost or erased as the changing economic and cultural landscape was just shifting around them. Whatever it was, The point here is that this affection idea fueled their point of view. Whether this affection idea was incomplete or whatever is irrelevant to the fact that it had power and it had force. It was true in its felt sense, and you can't argue with a feeling. When we debate ideology and argue positions, we're often missing the feeling or the affection behind the idea. The mistake is to look for the truth at the level of the idea, because that's not where it's at. For Spinoza, true or false, good or bad, are irrelevant and uninteresting. What's interesting is what they do and how they do it. Take, for example, this quote from Shannon Sullivan's Physiology of Sexist and Racist Oppression, an amazing book that you should read. Yes, your frightened gut response to the black man on the street is real. You really felt that. But your stomach's reaction is the beginning of the story, not the end. It is the psychophysiological symptom of a socio-political problem, not irrefutable evidence of a racially hierarchical reality. This biological reaction makes the white person the victim, or seem like the victim. The inadequate idea says that the motif of the dangerous black male is a felt reality, so it's a reality. He made me feel scared. He made me feel scared. Listen to that narrative. The narrative of white domination that's responsible for writing this character description in the first place is not taken into account. It's presumably too much to take into account, too much to take into the body, literally. When we're under threat, or feel we're under threat, our autonomic nervous system restricts gastrointestinal activity. The stomach and intestines stop digesting to save energy for more urgent survival functions. When we're in a fear response, we can't digest food, and we also can't digest new information. And this is not a metaphor. Sullivan argues in a really compelling way that the GI tract is actually the largest external surface of the body. What she means by external is that not everything that goes into our mouths actually enters our body. The stomach and the intestines are engaged in a, quote, transactional mingling with organism and environment, end quote, such that not everything that passes through the GI tract is actually let into the body. Some foods and realities are simply too unsavory to take in. In relation to Sullivan's earlier example, the contraction of the white gut holds more than fear. It holds a felt sense of entitlement. The white male stomach, generally speaking, is not accustomed to being clenched by fear of taking up space. The largely unconscious benefits of white supremacy include freedom of movement, access to space, the ability to feel at home wherever one is, to be able to walk down the street and be okay or be protected by cops. All of this, right? When the ontological expansiveness, as Sullivan calls it, is challenged, and mobility is restricted, the stomach follows suit and restricts. There's a visceral gut reaction to stepping out of the role of dominator and being made to feel, though often inaccurately, that one is no longer protected in the world. The body signals a threat because there is a threat. But perhaps it's not about the dangerous other. Maybe it's about losing privilege, or the discomfort of facing your own internalized racism. As Resmaa Menakem writes in My Grandmother's Hands, that white bodies also hold quite a good deal of ancestral and historical trauma, and it often gets confused or conflated and comes out as racism, as fear, as threat that is uncritical and unexamined. Resmaa Menakem talks a lot about the vagus nerve, which is connected to our automatic nervous system. And he says that the vagus nerve is not only where we experience our emotions, but where we feel a sense of belonging. Here, what makes white body supremacy so pervasive and intractable? Beneath the exclusion and constriction and trauma, white body supremacy offers the white body a sense of belonging. Okay, here's the punchline. If we want to create change, working at the level of ideology is a pretty ineffective strategy. And given the level of shit we're currently dealing with, the question of strategy is really important. I recently encountered the work of Christian Piccolini, an ex-Nazi who helped grow the American racist skinhead movement in his youth. He was the frontman of the oi band White American Youth and the leader of the Chicago Hammerskins. One of the factors that finally freed him from his racist ideologies was actually opening a record store, Chaos Records in Chicago. Maybe you've heard of it. Which forced him to interact with all kinds of people, including the people that he had formed such ignorant racist stories about. He says that once he began to know his customers of color by name, by what their interests were in music, he began to see them as people and had a gradual and total change of heart and left the movement. He recounts this mind-bending narrative in his book, White American Youth. Yeah, I know. This change of heart kind of sounds like some jargony Hallmark story about an unlikely transformation. But hear me out. From a Spinozian lens, it actually makes a lot of sense. From a somatic lens, it actually makes a lot of sense. Adequate ideas are given through proximity, through contact, through relationship. Ideology is representative in the sense that there is necessarily a distance involved. According to Spinoza, there is no possibility of being affected other than through contact. When bodies are in contact, they necessarily remodulate each other. This kind of change in mode and bodily constitution results from a mixture of bodies, a kind of mixture that can't happen through representational ideas. Okay. All that being said, a little disclaimer here. I'm not saying that we shouldn't continue to fight back and learn to keep ourselves safe from that rising trend toward mainstream fascism and Nazi acceptance that we're seeing play out right now. I woke up this morning feeling terrified of civil war. I woke up this morning with memories of police violence that I had just seen hours before running through a black neighborhood. I'm not saying that we shouldn't fight back. What I am saying is that these are defense strategies and not liberation strategies. If we want to fight Nazi ideology, if we want to change this at scale, we need a broader strategy. And Piccolini has found a quite successful one.
Since I've left the movement, I've helped over 100 people disengage from extremist movements, from white supremacist groups to even jihadist groups. And the way I do that is not by arguing with them, not by debating them, not by even telling them they're wrong, even though, boy, I want to sometimes. I don't do that. Instead, I don't push them away. I draw them in closer. And I listen very closely for their potholes. And then I begin to fill them in. I try to make people more resilient, more self-confident, more able to have skills to compete in the marketplace so that they don't have to blame the other that they've never met.
This This tactic of working with the affection idea could seem counterintuitive. Instead of forcing change, Pishalini offers support and allows the fear to soften until it becomes irrelevant. And it loses its compelling force, that force we were talking about that actually makes the ideology function. This is also a basic principle of how somatic healing works. In somatics, we blend with the contraction in the body by actually supporting it, not by trying to change it. Generally speaking, contractions are always taking care of something, even if that something is no longer present. They're about something. They're holding on to something. They may have kept us safe from feelings that were too hard to feel, or kept us from speaking up when it wasn't safe to do so. And they're holding tightly to that role. As a teacher of mine recently said, if you want to work with trauma, you have to work with everything but the trauma. This concept of blending comes from the somatic lineage of the Strizzi Institute and generative somatics, which pulls a lot of wisdom from Aikido, a non-combative martial art that is all about neutralizing an opponent instead of fighting or harming them. Our bodies are not our opponents, but it can feel like it sometimes. In somatics, blending means meeting and supporting a contraction instead of trying to force it to change. A former client of mine carried a collapsed chest in a pretty exaggerated way. His shoulders hung forward and his frown matched the shape. During a bodywork session, I placed my hands under his shoulders to support that collapse while he laid face up, and he pretty immediately started to tear up. Through the sobs, he said, "I just want to know that it's possible to be taken care of." While I was using my hands to support the weight of the world that was so constantly pushing his shoulders down, he was finally able to feel his grief of abandonment and a deep, deep longing to be taken care of, and let all that flow through. And the contraction that had kept his shoulders pulled forward for so long, it let go. Like a lot. When we blend with a contraction by supporting it, the brain and the nervous system receive the message that you don't have to do that anymore. Someone else is taking care of that now. This is a key principle of somatics. A contraction that has historically kept us safe will not let go until the body knows that there is another way to keep us safe. Our bodies need to know on a visceral level that there are other muscles and other mechanisms available that can take care of the fear that the trauma response, or let's say misinformed ideology, is protecting against. We have to know that what we're bracing against is either past or that we have more resources now to confront it than we did before.
I try to make people more resilient, more self-confident, more able to have skills to compete in the marketplace so that they don't have to blame the other.
This means updating the body's belief system by regenerating a sense of safety and power within our own bodies and our communities. This is not an intellectual process, but a somatic one. This is true of ideology as well. People generally won't change their ideas unless the stronghold of the idea is addressed at its root. What is the idea taking care of? Safety? Belonging? It feels important to say, and also really hard to say, that even a reaction of hate, though misdirected and misguided, is often one of the ways that a body is organizing for safety and belonging. There's a collection of stories and needs, longings, broken connections, trauma, so deeply suppressed that it accumulates into a misdirected felt sense that safety is only possible through extreme defensiveness, through harming another. There could be a million other things stirring inside a hater's body as well. This is the point. we are rarely making logical calculations. Deleuze once said that there is no such thing as ideology, and there never was. And I think he's right. Deleuze's attempt to debunk the myth of rationality and reassert that we are always operating within a field of affection ideas, assemblages, and swarms of meaning that coalesce into a felt sense of agency to defend our opinion as if it's truth. That makes sense to me. Ideologies, arguments, and information, these are not the waters we're swimming in. We're bodies with guts that are being wrenched by the daily news and the stories we are being told through the media, whether they're true or not. No one is acting at the level of rationality right now. That's not how politics works. That's not how bodies work. We're all activated and we're scared, and that's what's driving us. Our political stances are determined by which direction we are being pulled on an issue, literally. The way our stomachs are being clenched. We're all trying to manage pain as we move through the world. And there's no excuse whatsoever for the ways that some people try to manage that pain. But if we can shift our methods of discourse away from the hopeless realm of ideology, political, moral arguments, and engage in these deeper conversations about what shapes us and what shapes ideology in the first place, that, I think, could actually be transformative. It's a strategy. If we actually want things to change, we need to find their source. The complexity of social and political phenomenon and personal phenomenon can never be boiled down to a singularity. Many realities have come together to form the moments we're in and the ideologies we're in. If we don't see these current manifestations of complex historical and relational issues within a larger arc of time, we'll risk missing the swarm that carried the body toward an action in the first place, and we'll allow the swarm to carry on unnoticed and unstopped.
Either we're going to change or we're going to do this again and again. And while we're trying to convince white folk to finally leave behind a history that will maybe, or embrace a history that might set them free from being white. Finally.
Thanks so much for listening. You can find me on Instagram at body.podcast, and I'd love to hear from you. You can also support this project through the anchor page that's listed in my show notes. It would mean the world to me if you wanted to give a few bucks a month. It's really easy to become a monthly supporter, it just takes a few clicks, and it would allow this project to keep going. The next episode is an audio story that I made when I was in Miami recently. It's about memory and architecture, and about how I feel about neons and pastels. Spoiler alert, I love them.